Today is Monday, February 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the race to unseat President Trump heats up as moderate Democrats look to take down frontrunner Bernie Sanders.
Folks, vote is in your hands, not a joke. You can't control this outcome. I'm going to do everything in my power to earn your respect, earn your vote.
President Trump is expecting a hero's welcome when he visits India later this month.
We're going to have many millions and millions of people.
Also ahead, there seems to be no stopping 18-year-old pop sensation Billie Eilish. It's all on today's International Edition. Bernie Sanders commanding Nevada caucus victory made him a top target for his Democratic rivals and a growing source of anxiety for establishment Democrats worried that the nomination of a Nevada Democratic Socialist could cost the party in November. At a rally at the University of Houston, Sanders said, with all its diversity, people overestimate how conservative Texas really is.
If we can create a large voter turnout, we're going to win the Democratic primary a week from Tuesday. And I have every confidence that in November we're going to beat Trump here in Texas.
The prospect of his winning the nomination amplified concerns among Democrats who believe Sanders' call for a political revolution would drive moderate and independent voters away from the party. Speaking with reporters, Joe Biden says Bernie Sanders may be the front runner, but it's all about electability.
People are looking at now, not only, as I said, who can win and win the presidency, but who in fact is going to be in a position to be able to help maintain the House of Representatives, increase voters there, numbers there, and to win back the Senate. We got to do both in order to make our plans work.
Sanders' win solidified his frontrunner status in the crowded field as the race turned to Saturday's presidential primary in South Carolina, where his moderate opponents scrambled to try to blunt the Vermont senator's momentum. Meanwhile, a study by the Nielsen Rating Service says African Americans are among the nation's top consumers of social media, especially when it comes to information about presidential politics. A U.S. intelligence report says that made them a primary target of a Russian disinformation campaign to influence the 2016 presidential election. It's an effort Moscow is widely expected to repeat in this year's presidential contest. VOA's Chris Simpkins reports from the southern state of South Carolina, where African Americans say they're on the lookout for false content on social media.
And Joe Biden's going to have to do, he's going to have to separate himself from Obama.
These African American college students say they get most of their political information from social media.
You can, like, find out everything you need to know through social media and internet. So I think that's, like, the best outlet to, like, figure out everything.
But these voters say they are scrutinizing information they receive on social media about the 2020 presidential race, trying to figure out if it's real or not. The heightened awareness comes as security experts warn voters, especially African Americans, to be on the lookout for misinformation campaigns aimed at polarizing and dividing the electorate. Ron Wood says he saw Facebook content that aimed to keep him and others from voting in 2016.
They're going to do whatever in their power to discourage people from voting. And there again, if you're not engaged and you're not informed, then your vote can easily be depressed.
A U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee report released last year concluded Russian influencers targeted African Americans on social media more than any other group during the 2016 presidential campaign. South Carolina campaign worker Garrett McDaniel says it's vital African Americans and all voters verify political information on social media.
2016 definitely raised the red flag, especially when we saw how the Russian government was manipulating the black vote specifically, making false pages for advocacy groups like Black Lives Matter.
U.S. security officials say Russian trolls created fake social media posts to influence black voters. It was designed to exploit social divides and partisan loyalties and erode trust between Americans and their institutions.
In a broad respect, social media plays that role of sort of reinforcing individuals' sort of pre-existing views in some regards. And so I think it has that effect also in Black America. It becomes not just an echo chamber, but really kind of Black social media serves as a forum for community discourse and discussion.
The Senate Intelligence Report maintains thousands of Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube accounts were created by the Russian-based Internet Research Agency to harm Hillary Clinton's campaign and support Donald Trump. Monica Bickert, head of global policy for Facebook, told U.S. lawmakers how the company plans to guard against Russian influence in the 2020 elections.
As soon as we find something that those fact-checking organizations rate false on our platform, we dramatically reduce the distribution and we put next to it related articles so that anybody who shares that gets a warning that this has been rated false.
Davian Petty works with students at South Carolina State University on how to decipher political information on social media. He says he's optimistic going forward.
I think with the exposure from this past election, I think we don't have to worry about that as much because it's under high scrutiny, you know, under high watch.
Social media companies say they've redoubled security measures aimed at finding and removing coordinated manipulation campaigns before they spread malign content. Even so, many African Americans say they are taking matters in their own hands and striving to be more careful social media users. Chris Simpkins, VOA News, Columbia, South Carolina.
Meanwhile, U.S. National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien says that he's not seen any evidence that Russia's doing anything to help President Donald Trump get reelected, but acknowledges he has not sought out intelligence reports that allege Moscow is interfering in the 2020 election. Trump, who departed for a trip to India on Sunday, has dismissed any suggestion Russia wants him to win the November election.
At the White House Sunday, President Trump and the First Lady boarded Marine One to start a 36-hour trip to India. Trump last week announced he would name the U.S. ambassador to Germany, Richard Grenell, as acting director of national intelligence. The previous acting director, Joseph McGuire, was cast aside by Trump after an aide to McGuire recently briefed a House committee on Russian interference in the 2020 presidential election.
After 3 years of ridiculous witch hunts and partisan Democrat crusades, by the way, I think they're starting another one. They said today that Putin wants to be sure that Trump gets elected. Here we go.
According to news reports, the aide to McGuire said Russia favored the president, angering Trump, who feared the information could be used against him.
I haven't seen any intelligence that Russia is doing anything to attempt to get President Trump reelected. I think this is the same old story that we've heard before. And our message to the Russians is stay out of the U.S. elections. We've been very tough on Russia, and we've been great on election security. So I think it's a non-story.
Election security remains a contentious issue at the U.S. Capitol. Senate Republicans this month blocked three election security-related bills introduced by Democrats. O'Brien questioned why Russia would support Trump's re-election.
Why would Russia want the president who's rebuilt the American military, who's given the Ukrainians lethal arms, javelin missiles, and has sanctioned the Russians far more than any president in recent history, why would they want him re-elected? I mean, that just doesn't make common sense.
The president this week pointed to reports of Russian efforts to help the campaign of a rival, Democratic presidential candidate Senator Bernie Sanders. In response to those reports, Sanders told the Washington Post he doesn't care who Russian leader Vladimir Putin wants to win the 2020 election. He said his message to Putin is clear: stay out of American elections, and as president, I will make sure that you do. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. Iran's voter turnout was below 50%, a first since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The World Health Organization warns it's running out of money to tackle the Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Nigerian traders facing business threats as many industries in China remain closed. And Trump says if a partial truce holds, he would put his name on a Taliban peace deal. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Donald Trump's upcoming visit to India will be packed with a welcome that has in many countries eluded him, a rally with a crowd of millions cheering him on, an election year love fest of sorts.
Well, I look forward to being with the people of India. We're going to have many millions and millions of people. It's a long trip, but I get along very well with the Prime Minister Modi. He's a friend of mine. I committed to this trip a long time ago, and I look forward to go.
He left this afternoon after hosting Modi at a Howdy Modi rally in Houston last year that drew 50,000 people. Modi will return the favor with a, quote, Namaste Trump rally at the world's largest cricket stadium in the western Indian city of Ahmedabad. Trump's motorcade will travel amid cheers from carefully picked and screened Modi loyalists and workers who will stand for hours alongside a 22-kilometer stretch of road to give Trump a grand welcome. New cases of the COVID-19 coronavirus seem to be stabilizing in China, but appear to be spreading worldwide. And scientists say it could reach a tipping point where it's spreading faster than they can get a handle on it. Joining us now to talk more about this and bring us up to date on concerns, Arthur Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center, founding director of the Division of Medical Ethics. Thank you so much for being with us, sir. Do you think this is, in fact, reaching a tipping point when it comes to spreading faster?
I'm sorry to say I don't agree that we've reached a tipping point that's positive. I think we're starting to see outbreaks in Iran, Italy, South Korea, maybe Japan, and some underreporting out of China that make me worry that we're going to see more spread of the virus. I think it seems to be pretty contagious. I think efforts to try and contain the virus have been, haphazard, slapdash, not strong. You know, some places have sort of quarantined a boat. Other places, like Cambodia, said, come on ashore, everybody off. So I think we still got further months ahead of this turning into sort of a pandemic.
And how are they supposed to contain it if there are people without symptoms that could potentially be spreading it?
Yeah. So it's very difficult when people can be asymptomatic. And by the way, we also haven't established whether people are asymptomatic and don't develop the disease. That is, they simply remain infectious and they never show us signs of the disease. That can happen with the flu sometimes, for example. So I suspect containment is not a way to control this. It's a way to slow down the spread, hopefully, buying some time until we either get a vaccine or some type of a antiviral drug. But I've never been a big believer that quarantine in an era of airplanes and boats and train travel and people going all over the world pretty quickly, that that's really going to stop the spread of a disease.
So you think quarantine? So you think antivirals and vaccines are the way to go?
I think our best defense is really a couple of things. Keep pursuing in an open science, sharing way, vaccines and some type, hopefully, of therapy, some antiviral medicine that actually works well against this thing. It's a challenge. Remember, this is a kind of cold virus, and sadly, as we all know, we've never come up with a medicine for the common cold. So, tough virus, but if we can get everybody pulling together, all the pharmaceutical companies, universities, exchanging information, treating it as an unusual circumstance where they don't worry about trade secrets or publication priority, I think that's good, and I think I'm seeing some of that. I think we have to have a good healthcare system with people trained to take care of folks. I'm not sure every country's done that. We've had some experience with Ebola and Zika and other diseases where a lot of our ICU people know how to protect themselves and have the equipment. So I think that's a plus. I think in some of these countries like rural China, they don't. And that's been a problem in terms of both spreading the disease but also dying from it. And I think we got to be ready to wash our hands, maybe stay away from other people. Should we really get an outbreak in the U.S., a little less visit to the train station or the bus station or the airport or even maybe to the supermarket for a while. So we have to be prepared for some social isolation. That's the bad news. Good news is it's getting warmer, and we're headed towards spring and summer, at least in the North America. So that means people can go outside and not have to come into close contact in close quarters as much, which is why, by the way, the flu and other diseases like that die down every year in the summer.
But it could take months, obviously, for a vaccine or even a potential antiviral that would work for this. Isn't that pretty much, is that an accurate statement?
It's accurate to say that it'll take months more to find something, test it, at least for safety, and a little bit of a signal of efficacy. That's going to take a little time. And then the reality is this. Ethically, we won't have a supply of whatever it is, the vaccine or the treatment, overnight. It's going to take time to manufacture it. Mm. And now we're talking about doses for the world, you know, billions of doses. Mm. So there's going to be shortage, and we have to put plans in place to say who's going first if we got a vaccine, who's going first if we got a therapy. I think there's some argument that doctors and nurses, people work in hospitals and keep them running, have to go first. You're probably going to try and help kids if they're more prone, say babies, to trouble. And then we have to have a transparent debate about how we're going to do this. So even if somebody announces tomorrow, I've got a medicine that looks like it kills this virus, you're still months away from being able to make it in large amounts.
All right. That is Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University Langone Medical Center. Thank you for being with us. Australians have been taking time to remember all that was lost after devastating months-long bushfires killed more than 30 people, destroyed thousands of homes, and killed millions of animals and destroyed habitats. Shane Fitzsimmons is the New South Wales Fire Commissioner.
They died as heroes, selfless individuals, paying the ultimate price while simply serving and protecting others in their local community and communities much further afield.
Noting those who died trying to contain the fires and assist with rescues, including American firefighters who died in a helicopter crash fighting the fires as well as all the others who have suffered.
25 lives have been taken by this bushfire season. Each one of those is a story of grief, of profound loss and great sadness, of lives cut short and of families being changed forever.
Australia set up a national inquiry last week into the crisis that affected 3 in 4 Australians and prompted widespread criticism of the government for its sluggish response to the blazes. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said the vast scale of the fires, which killed more than 30 people and destroyed thousands of homes, required a new response from the bushfire-prone nation. Well, as the world works to save millions of species from extinction, activists work to stop the enormous problem of poaching and wildlife trafficking on the African continent. Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice joins us from Nairobi with details about a project he's working on to help train prosecutors dealing with the big business of wildlife trade. Jack, thank you for taking the time. Tell us about it.
This really is an industry of sorts, because what we're really talking about is organized crime and terrorist organizations who are using this to fund their operations. So the idea is to reach in to make prosecutors better and more effective. And I use my former CIA training in some senses, but also my prosecution and defense training and the legal front to sort of bring it all together and hopefully make things a little better.
Now, are these Kenyan prosecutors, or are they from all over the continent?
These ones are Kenyan. In the past, I worked with Ugandan, Kenyan, Tanzanian, but this time around, these are specifically Kenyan prosecutors working with the Kenyan Wildlife Service. And so that's part of what we're working on.
How does this tie in as far as organized crime and wildlife trafficking?
What's amazing is sometimes people are trying to think about who takes down rhinos, who takes down lions, who takes down elephants. Well, mostly it's done by large organizations, and organized crime really runs this. And when I say organized crime, I mean crime syndicates internationally as well as terrorist organizations who then use this to fund their operations themselves. Because think of it like this. It's not just about acquiring that pelt. It's not just about acquiring that rhino horn. It's about acquiring it and then shipping it out of the country and then distribution once it's out of the country. And so the idea is to be able to track all of those and then ultimately prosecute those in the most effective way.
And is the Kenyan government in support of these prosecutors getting a better handle on this, or are they complicit and just not really focused on that right now?
Well, the answer is yes to both. I think there is a need for this, absolutely. But think of it this way. If you look at the overall economy in just Kenya alone, it's somewhere between 15 and 20% of the entire economy has to do with tourism tied to wildlife. So in other words, this is a fundamental source of income for the country itself. And it's just year after year after year. So you kill a rhino. The thing is you never get that back. It's now gone. Whereas if you have that rhino, you can make money off of people who want to see that rhino year after year after year after year, and their offspring, ideally. And so that's a part of it. But the problem is that the kinds of money we're talking about here can be so extreme in a very poverty-ridden country that you can drive people into corruption, and that's exactly what happens. I mean, here's a simple example. Is if you think about the value of a rhino horn, it is the most valuable substance on the planet. It's more valuable than diamonds, gold, cocaine. $75,000 per kilo. So in other words, your average rhino horn, about 3 kilos, 225,000. You can fit 5 rhino horns in a rucksack. That's $1 million.
But this is not an infinite commodity.
No, it's not. And so that's the intent here, is to try to bring in all of these organizations, prosecutors, we're also talking about rangers and wardens, those to try to stop it in the first place, to prosecute those who are dealing with it secondarily, to really help prop up the rule of law in East Africa and across the continent itself. Because remember, this is the ripple effect. If you don't do this, what you then do is fund those various criminal elements, fund those terrorist organizations. And in fact, as an example, if you look at the situation involving Al-Shabaab when they came in and attacked the Westgate Gate Mall in Nairobi, killing some 69 people back in 2013, that was funded specifically by Elephant Tusk. That's how they paid for it. So this is about that, as well as it's about trying to keep these animals alive, trying to keep the environment propped up as best we can possibly do it.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, we appreciate your taking the time to tell us about it. Thank you so much. You're listening to International Edition. We will be back in a minute.
On Our Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. A recently planned redesign of the $20 bill would have put the image of famous abolitionist Harriet Tubman on the front, but that was shelved by the Trump administration. So New York illustrator Dina Cooper has decided to go ahead and start putting Tubman on as many 20s as she can find. Nina Venetia has the story narrated by Anna Rice.
Brooklyn illustrator Dina Cooper is doing what the U.S. Treasury Department said it would do years ago. She's swapping the face of President Andrew Jackson for that of abolitionist Harriet Tubman on $20 bills. Well, she's stamping one on top of the other, rather.
I just kind of did a study on her face for these 6 different angles, and then I took these as reference, and that's how I made the final artwork.
The decision to stamp her own Harriet Tubman bills came to Cooper after the U.S. Treasury postponed its decision to print new $20 bills that would have Harriet Tubman's face printed on the front and moving the portrait of the U.S.'s 7th president.
Andrew Jackson is not a great figure in American history. He enacted the Indian Removal Act. So I think that we should definitely consider who we're enshrining on our currency.
The changes were supposed to happen in 2020 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment that allowed women to vote. Yet the initiative was tabled by the Trump administration until 2026. Dina Cooper decided not to wait. She was eager to see the first African-American woman portrayed on the national currency as soon as possible.
I grew up only 40 minutes away from where Harriet Tubman was enslaved. And so this is something that I've heard of for a long time. I've been hearing about her legacy and the things that she did for the Underground Railroad.
Cooper is not alone. A number of like-minded activists support her and use their own means and finances to create rebranded $20 bills. Today, there are more than 1,500 new banknotes in the country, in New York, Virginia, Michigan, and California.
Someone came up to us actually at a table and asked what we were doing and said, "This looks very shady. I want to know what you're doing." And they contributed 20s too.
Okay, I have 20. Can you do it?
Mm-hmm. Giving the $20 bill a new face is perfectly legal, Cooper says. As long as the special magnetic stripes are intact, the bill has to be accepted anywhere in the country. ATMs don't have a problem with them. Cooper says that after this experiment, she started considering other banknotes as well.
Benjamin Franklin wasn't a president. Why is he on our currency?
But Cooper admits she can never take on one of the founding fathers. So the $100 bills seem to be safe. Vanina Vishnyova in New York, NRI's Daily News.
Teenage pop star Billie Eilish scored yet another record on Friday as her new single enjoyed the biggest opening week of all time for a James Bond theme in the British charts. Her song No Time to Die landed straight in at number one according to the official singles chart. She became the 18-year-old's first British chart topper. The single was co-written and produced by Eilish and her brother, Phineas, and earned 90,000 chart sales and 10.5 million plus streams, making it the biggest opening week for a single so far this year. The ballad has that grungy, melancholic feel that has propelled her to star status and, of course, caps a remarkable couple of weeks for the teen. She has been a breakout star. She was a breakout star at the Grammys, sweeping 5 awards, including the Big Four prizes, Album of the Year, Song of the Year, Record of the Year, and Best New Artist. Was I reckless to help? Was it obvious to everybody else that I've fought? You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. Yeah.